Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. And Happy New Year to anyone who I haven't said it to. And if you want to know the official day that we can stop saying Happy New Year, I think it's after Martin Luther King Day, just so that everyone is aware of that. Please let me know if you can't hear me or see me. Want to make sure that we have a very interactive session. And with that, you know, today I wanted to really, as our first session of the new year, focus on what we're seeing today and where we need to go tomorrow. And unfortunately, Dr. Roberson from the Department of Health will not be able to join us. And after many conversations, the backup speaker to Dr. Roberson also will not be able to join us today. So, you know, in full disclosure, I want you all to know that we decided to move forward and have a very interactive session. So all of you are now our special guests, and we hope when it's time we can get some questions and concerns and what you're seeing in your communities and in your facilities addressed so that we can have a open and full discussion. But, you know, as always, I want to make sure that we go over some things like the state of the state and look at some trends that we're seeing. So wanted to start just with looking at the COVID metrics that we're seeing, and this is from the COVID Tracking Project. You know, we're seeing us that we are doing we are seeing a spike in hospitalizations, and we're going to go over that in a little bit. We are seeing more deaths per day, and you know, we are seeing a surge in cases. So when we look at where we're at, globally, we're over 91 million cases and over 1.9 million deaths. In the United States, we're still leading with cases, with us being, as of this morning, reported out to be over 22.8 million cases with over 380,000 deaths. What that means is that when we're looking at the moving average for the United States, we're seeing a positivity rate of 12.89%. And I was on the World Health Organization earlier today and looking at what the sources of transmission, because they actually do now look at each country and see if there are clusters of cases versus if this is the same community transmission. And I think we're all very much aware of the travel that has happened over Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year. And so while in December we were really living through that Thanksgiving surge, it feels like we're in the we're still seeing the early component, the early part of the Christmas and New Year surge. We haven't peaked yet, but if we're following the trends, we should see the peak soon. What that means is that if we're looking at all of our states, the majority of us are over that higher than recommended positivity rate, with Florida 7-day moving average being at 13%. As of the 11th, which was Monday, our average was positivity rate was 10.62% percent, with new cases being over 14,000 a day. This is another view from the COVID tracking project. And so this shows the percentage of hospital beds with COVID patients. And I don't think it's any surprise. We know what's going on in Florida. We know what's going on in the East Coast. California and Arizona, you can't even make out the lines because of how many bubbles are there. And if you're ever on this site, you can drill down to see by zip code to see what was happening. What I looked at this morning was how we are doing with ICU beds. And we're seeing, you know, especially here in California and in parts of Arizona, we're seeing that we are exceeding and way over the number of ICU beds that are available. And I think that follows along with some of the latest news reports that we're getting out of those states. Just in looking at what we're also seeing when it comes to healthcare disparities, we have noted that while we're seeing an increase in cases amongst those Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders, we are seeing a higher rate of death in the African American community. So those are still some trends. And even if you had a desire, we could go into each state and down to the county level on the COVID tracking project as well. So let's go into what's happening in Florida just to look. You know, we're over, as of this morning, this was updated at 11 a.m., we're over 1.5 million cases, over 23,000 deaths. And as I said, the positivity rate has remained quite high in Florida. When we are thinking about the variants, you know, there's some tracking of this on the CDC's website, which is where this map comes from. And in looking at where we're seeing the COVID variant B.1.1.7, we have seen 32 cases in California and 22 cases in Florida, which are the states that are the number one and number two for seeing these variants. The thing is that many of those, the first, if you recall, I believe the first case that we saw in Florida was from someone who did not have any known travel. And we saw that same thing in Colorado and in California, and I believe when New York reported its first case too. So we are following that. What I do know, and I haven't seen much research yet around this, just some opinions and editorials. So if someone is seeing something different, please let us know. What I have seen is that when we're looking at the variants, there is 23 mutations in that variant that makes it differ from the virus that we were seeing initially in the early 2020. There are still no reports on this impacting mortality different, but you know, we do know that it spreads the transmission rates with this new variant are higher. What we have also, I think there's a lot of research that is going on right now to make sure that the vaccinations that we're seeing, there's no difference in the way this variant responds to those vaccines versus the other. So when we're looking at some trends in long-term care, you know, want to start first by looking at what's happening in Florida. So in Florida, we've seen, you know, pretty consistent numbers, although the positivity rate amongst residents in both SNFs and ALFs has increased to 2.53%. Amongst staff, the positivity rate has remained pretty consistent with the numbers as of yesterday being at 1.56%. So there are some other entities that are tracking the long-term care data, and we know that we have over a million cases in long-term care, and we have over 133,000 deaths. So when you're looking at, even though there's like less than 1% of the American population living in long-term care, we're accounting for such a high percentage of the COVID deaths in the United States. This is also a map, interactive map that's on the COVID tracking project. And Florida, you know, we're seeing 37% of our COVID-19 deaths are related to individuals in long-term care. Not every state reports their data, so we're not getting that consistently throughout the United States, but it is interesting. You can look up your state and look up where you're seeing the trends at as well. So just to break it down a little bit further, of the 67,000 total cases in long-term care, over 8,400 total deaths, and over 1,200 facilities have been affected. So there is some a lot of consistent data. And, you know, I think that's why there was a major push to make sure our long-term care facilities, and a major push from, you know, with Operation Warp Speed to make sure the long-term care facilities were vaccinated first. When we're looking at vaccines, this is a summary from the state of Florida. And in total, we've had over 648,000 individuals being vaccinated. The first dose is over almost about 600,000. It may be changing with the updated numbers over the last 2 days, but 597,119 have received the first dose. Over 51,000 have completed the series. And this is really data coming out of the Pfizer vaccine. We do know that Moderna is now being offer too. So hopefully we'll see even more numbers. What I will say for the state of Florida, we've seen a lot of variability in scheduling appointments and getting individuals vaccinated. I know some of those things have made it to the media, but as we're looking at these numbers, we know that we were one of the first states to start vaccinating our 65 plus year olds out in the community. So we do see that we're doing that, even though there are some long waits. There are a lot of difficulties getting appointments right now, depending on which county you're in. But on the upside, you know, we have seen that in Hernando County, and I believe two other counties, the governor did allow for Publix, one of the grocery store chains, to start administering vaccines. So that is, I thought that was really positive news. What we're looking at the past 2 weeks, I think we are seeing that there's been a good progression, over the last few weeks. Most of the issues that we're seeing right now is really driven by supply. There is a demand. I don't know how many of you have seen this, but there is definitely a demand amongst some of our population to get the vaccine. We are still seeing a lot of hesitancy with staff in the getting the vaccination. And that is not only hesitancy within our long-term care population, in the people who work in our facilities, but even in the hospital setting. I was talking to a nurse the other day about getting the vaccine because she had a question over pregnancy, which, you know, over a potential pregnancy that she wants to have one day, you know, because there's unfortunately a lot of misinformation and there was some concern. And I was very surprised that this was coming from someone within our profession. But yet it is unfortunately wasn't even the only question that I received that day. So I can only imagine what we're seeing. When we're looking at the United States, I know this says updated on December 20th, but these are the latest numbers, about 9.3 million, a little bit over 9.3 million have received the first dose. It also on the CDC website shows how much vaccine was distributed to long-term care facilities and the number of people who have received the first dose in the long-term care facilities. This is, I believe, is only about the patients and not really about more information is coming about patients. So I'm not sure how much of this, that number is residents versus staff, trying to still explore that to get a better sense of where we're at. This is just another view from the world in data, and it just shows that, you know, I was actually trying to confirm the CDC numbers, and it shows that we are seeing that more vaccine has been distributed to individuals. But if you're following from state to state, the issue is really around supply, trying to make sure that they're not going to run out of vaccine by the end of next week, which has been reported by many states. So in thinking, and where I would like for us to spend the remainder of our time, is really in thinking about what do we need to see happen over the next few weeks to months, and what it means. And I was, as I was trying to figure out how to continue to have this session, I started thinking about the statement that tomorrow is now, and spent maybe a little bit too much time looking for where this quote came from, and realized it was from Eleanor Roosevelt's book. So I want to make sure that we are understanding that, you know, tomorrow is now. And so there are questions that we need to address now. The first being, are we testing enough? You know, there's still a lot of reports that suggest that we may not be testing enough, even though we have the availability between the kits that you could get at home to test yourself, the pharmacies that are offering testing, whether it be the PCR versus the rapid antigen. We're seeing now testing at different airports so that people can plan their travel. There has been reports, though, that it's still not enough because we're still seeing high, we're still seeing such surging numbers of cases and high positivity rates. Should we be testing more? You know, are we vaccinating enough? And I think many of us on this call would probably agree that we may not be. You know, we still have a lot of hesitancy and aversion to the vaccine, more than, you know, I think in line with some of what we anticipated, but some of the questions that I receive on a daily basis are more than I would thought from individuals who I would have imagined were educated on what the vaccine was and how it is. And then a lot of people, it feels like they're doing vaccine shopping, as if we are in a boutique and are like, I want Moderna versus Pfizer, Pfizer versus Moderna. A lot of interesting comments about which vaccine they should get. And then the big question that I've been having and that I wanted to explore is, what can we do to improve the process? How do we deliver more vaccine in our facilities, in our communities, et cetera? And how should we be leading through this time? So it is at this point that I'm going to open it up to everyone so that we can have a discussion around where do we need to go. And if you're on mute, I would ask you to take yourself off of mute. And I don't know, Shane, I'm not following the chat, so I don't know if we have any questions yet.
And Diane. Hi, it's Claudia. How are you?
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. So I think one of the things, and for those that don't know me, I'm Claudia. I work for Grand Villa Senior Living, and I'm the regional executive director. But I think one of the biggest concerns with the vaccination, and this community specifically that I'm in today, they're going to get their vaccine this Sunday, and then I have another community Friday and Saturday. But some of the things that I've seen, is the hesitation from staff. There is a lot of hesitation, and you know, I think it comes from they're afraid of the side effects, they're afraid of so many things. You know, some of them tell me one thing, you know, either misinformation or things that they see on social media. And what I've told them is, you know, social media is not a reliable source. You know, go to the CDC, you know, go to valuable websites that you can find some information about the vaccine. And then the other thing, colleagues of mine, they actually asked me if my company would make it mandatory, and if they can make it mandatory for staff to have this vaccine. I've heard that some companies are making it mandatory. Specifically to mine, they're not. And, you know, that has been a big debate legally. what can they do, what can they not do, what can the company do. You know, and I was on an ACA call the other day, and I think something like that came up, and ACA said they're not going to mandate it as of now.
As far as making it mandatory, I believe Dr. Leslie Eber, which she was on in December, stated that with an emergency use authorization, you cannot make it mandatory to deliver the vaccine. So I think that that is one of the issues in mandating everyone to get it. The other issue that you brought up about staff resistance, that's what I'm hearing a lot. There's a lot of misinformation. And unfortunately, when we're looking at for sources of truth, we too many of our staff and clinicians are often trusting what's on social media. So I think being consistent and making sure that we are explaining to people what is happening and what we see when we're getting the shot. You know, I know I've been asked to videotape myself getting the second shot because I have to now talk to a state about getting this shot, you know, so it is, there's a lot of things that have to happen. And I think what I would suggest is, and I don't know how this works as a whole in each facility, but whatever opportunity we have to dispel the misinformation, whether that is in services or, you know, asking your staff to participate in one of the many webinars, I think, you know, we just need to go through and say, okay, this is what we're hearing. This is not the truth. This is why this is the truth. And like really speaking to that, you know, and it's going to take a lot more than what we're having, because there's resistance from so many different communities. And then the interesting thing is you get that resistance, and then you get people who are wanting to take the vaccine. And I think there's a lot of problems. I know some facilities are having difficulty because in some states they've actually had to waste vaccine because of the problem of staff resistance. We also had a question about testing reliability. Since we're testing twice a week, they have a staff have negative PCR and 3 days later are positive. There's, you know, no rhyme or reason. So that is an issue. And I don't know, I may have to call like on someone like Dr. Auslander. I don't know if you have any insight on the testing issues that Debbie Brazil is experiencing.
I think the testing issues are extremely complicated. And last night, I read a paper that was submitted to the Journal of the American Geriatric Society that kind of totally blew my mind away because it's so confusing. I'm not sure we understand what's going on, but I can share some of this. So these are data that will be published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. It's from a convenience sample of close to 700 nursing home residents who had PCR viral testing. And they looked at the period after and a short period before the PCR test was done. They had the electronic health record data. And all these people also had antibody testing at some point after the PCR testing. And and it wasn't a random sample, it was a convenience sample, but the results showed that the proportion of people who had antibodies after that index test date was the same, almost the same, in people who had a positive PCR test versus a negative PCR test. And there wasn't even a direct relationship with people who developed symptoms, although the people who had a positive PCR test and positive antibodies more often had typical symptoms of COVID. So I think it's very, very confusing. I'm not sure how to explain all that information. I'm certainly no epidemiologist or virologist, but it made me pause to think that I'm not sure we know exactly what's going on. But what can I just ask, what specifically are you concerned about? What is there a specific issue that I might be able to address?
Yeah, I think the issue that she raised was that they were testing twice a week, and they had staff who were negative and then 3 days later positive, and then 3 days later negative again.
And what test?
It was a PCR.
Yeah, so, you know, PCR tests, as far as I understand, have a 10 to 20% false negative rate. I've seen that happen in staff and residents. I'm not sure exactly how to explain it. So one explanation is that the staff member acquired the virus, had a negative test, then acquired the virus, but wasn't shedding enough virus to have a positive test. And then on the second test, they were shedding enough virus to have a positive test. And on the third test, it could have been a false negative. Or I think some of it has to do with how much viral load is being shed. But do you have a sense of the time course there?
I'm not sure. And I don't know if Debbie is still with us. Yeah, I did read something, and I think from the AMDA, Dr. Nace, from our AMDA president, he also is doing some research on the viral load and how that impacts.
I think that's part of it. Also, another part of it is the timing, Diane, because if you acquire the virus, and you have enough of a viral load, you start shedding replication competent virus within 48 to 72 hours. And the peak of that is 4 to 5 days. And then after about 10 days, it's very low in an otherwise healthy person. That's the basis of the current guidance. After 10 days, people who have had the virus who have not been very, very sick are not shedding replication competent virus anymore. So some of the answer has to do with the timing. Some of it may have to do with the viral load. And you always have to remember that some of these tests, I don't know what causes the false negative test. Now for me, one of the things that's been very hard to understand is false positive tests, especially with PCR. In this article I read last night, they referenced two or three papers where that there may be some cross reactivity with other coronaviruses that's causing false positives. But that may also be for the antibody too. So all I can say is I thought I understood this pretty well. But I'm not sure I do anymore.
No, I think one of the interesting things that we've been talking about amongst some of the group was about the variants, and so trying to understand all of that has been like mind-boggling. So there's just so much to understand.
Managing your patient's needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete, quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
When will the FDA's EUA of Pfizer, Moderna, COVID-19 get fully approved? That will take a while. You know, so the emergency, we're using those two vaccines as an emergency use authorization. It usually takes, months to like, it may be 12 months to get a full approval. I don't know if anyone else has any other insight in how the FDA approves it, but that is the latest information that was shared with me.
So Diane, I have one comment related to the vaccine hesitancy among staff. Mm-hmm. So we there was a survey done in the state of Indiana of all long-term care staff. And this is now published online, and I can't remember how many, but it was, might've been 3,000 staff. I mean, they did it very rapidly about their willingness to take the vaccine. And what the staff said was initially about 40% said they would take it immediately, but another 20% said they would probably take it after it's been out a while. So all in all, close to 70% of the respondents to that survey said that they would take the vaccine. And I guess the message for the group is that even if staff don't take it on the first round, keep pushing them. And I think what you're doing is, I did a little video clip about getting a shot. And I think the more you can do video clips, and even if you can video yourself getting the shot and show it to staff, I think that'll help. Lead by example.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is the one thing that those of us who are clinicians in the building, medical directors of our facilities, administrators and DONs, if we could lead by example and be that example to show our CNAs and nurses that this is safe, that is always helpful. I'm curious to know, and I don't know if we had any further insight, has there been any other facility that has not yet been scheduled for their vaccine clinic? And which pharmacy are you working with is a question I will want to know. And what have you done with that?
Diane?
Yes, Dr. Kaplan.
Hi. Actually a question and a comment. I'll start with a question to Dr. Auslander. Joe, are you aware of what the original proposed sensitivity and specificity of PCR testing was upon initiation, and have there been any studies and follow-up with comparison to those initial numbers?
I can partially answer it. When the PCR tests were first promulgated, they were supposed to be very, very, they were supposed to be about 80 to 90% sensitive, meaning they had a 10 to 20% false negative rate.
Right.
And like I said, I don't understand, other than contamination of the equipment, how you get a false positive or mixing.
I think there was a question actually in the chat. Do you know what the percentage of false positives actually is?
With PCR, I think it's extremely low. I mean,
less than 5%, like two.
Oh, even less than that.
Yeah.
But with the rapid antigen test, I think it's higher. I mean, anecdotally, the group I work with, Life Space Communities, has had numerous false positive antigen tests, which is why I think it's generally recommended to use only if in symptomatic people, and even then, if it's positive, to verify it. But just if somebody's symptomatic, do it. If it's positive, then quarantine them and verify it with a PCR.
PCR, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
Thanks. Diane, the comment I was going to make, okay, is one of the ways perhaps to get a little bit of a change of heart with staff regarding the vaccination is, this is kind of serendipitous and unfortunate, is to actually have, I hate to say this, but have an outbreak in your building of COVID, okay? So we've had in one of our buildings where we had 23% staff accepting vaccination on the first go around 2 weeks ago. Since then, we've had two staff members and subsequently seven residents who have been positive. Fortunately, only one of those was really symptomatic, both resident and staff. But now we've probably seen at least 10 to 15% increase in staff mindset with regard to acceptance of the vaccination. And that particular facility is due for the second dose in a week. And a lot of those people are going to be receiving their first dose and make arrangements with CVS, et cetera, to receive their second dose afterwards. So just as a comment, I know that obviously no one wants to go down that road, but it is interesting how the mindset works.
But that's not going to be unique, Bob, because yesterday the CDC published some data. I don't know if Diane reviewed it or not, because I had to be away for a couple minutes. But in the morbidity and mortality weekly report,
mm-hmm. No, I didn't report that. I didn't record. Yeah. I didn't report on that.
So they, you can pull it off the CDC website. It's very scary data to me, because what they showed is the, you know, as accurate as it can be, due to all the reporting issues. They showed the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in residents and staff going from May through November 22nd. And there was a little bit of a bump in July and early August. And the number of confirmed cases is equal in residents and staff. And that number, the way they report it, comes out to be about 12, at that time it was 12,000 positives per 1,000 resident years. So you have to figure out how many resident years it is, how many resident years. Like if you have 100 residents, for 1,000 resident months, I think it is. I don't want to misquote. I think it's months. Let me pull it up just to be sure. But my point is that by November 22nd, before Thanksgiving, that number had doubled. It doubled. Wow. That was before the Thanksgiving holiday. So they didn't have data after Thanksgiving. And think about what could happen now after the winter holidays. So I think what I keep telling the group I work with is just don't let your guard down. Yep. Keep vigilant. It is so scary. And I don't think anybody's doing anything on purpose. But let me just give you the number so I don't misquote it. It came out yesterday.
It's a good point that you're making. Don't let your guard down. Yeah. You know, that's leading by example. You get the vaccine, you still wear your mask, you still.
Yes, absolutely. It's so important. So the number is actually, I misquoted, the number at November 22nd, in both, it's a little higher in residents, about 24 to 25,000 confirmed cases per 1,000 resident weeks. So, if you have 100 residents and in a year, that would be like 5,000 resident weeks.
And that was in the MMR?
It's just yesterday. It was published yesterday. I can send it to you. I'll send it to you.
We definitely want to put that in our library.
And the other thing that was published, I got from AMDA. I don't know if you mentioned it. The WHO came out with some very detailed recommendations.
Yes. So that was something that I was just going to mention. The World Health Organization, they are looking at some new information about delaying vaccine doses in between, like the interval may be extended to 42 days, which is 6 weeks, based off of some current data. And, you know, I'm going to try to pull that article so that we could have it in our library. I want to point out that Dr. Zorwitz added an article, a link into the chat, and we're going to capture that too, which is a comparison of the 7 commercial PCR diagnostic kits that I believe you could do at home. We had a question of can you do a home testing without a prescription? And the answer is yes, there are several vendors who can send you a kit at home. Some you could either pay or use your insurance so that you could do it. But I think before doing it, read the article Dr. Zorwitz just highlighted. There was also a question about point of care testing. If it comes in positive, can you repeat it immediate? And thanks again, Bob, for answering that question. The recommendation is that if you get a point of care quick test that is positive, you should confirm with a PCR. So taking another point of care test is not sufficient to make that confirmation. Any other questions or comments or concerns?
I just wanted to add something to that. This is Bob again. Because that reminded me of, you know, in residency when a test would come back abnormal, you know, the first impulse would be to repeat the test. But then if the repeat comes back normal, you don't know which one was the right one. And so I think in general, repeating abnormal tests is problematic. And especially when you have a test that has, you know, when these rapid tests can have high false positive and false negatives, repeating it is not very helpful because you don't know whether the second test is right or the first test is right.
Yep, thank you for that. There's also another article, I believe a news article that was shared by in the chat, and we'll capture that as well. Are there any other comments, questions, or concerns?
And I sent you those two articles I mentioned, so you can
Perfect.
Post them over.
Yeah.
And Bob, I agree with you. I've always been leery about that. In so many situations where that occurs. I think, though, in this situation, there's enough information to suggest that, at least for the rapid antigen tests, that they probably should be verified. I don't know what you think about that.
Oh, no, I think it should be verified by a PCR.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And not repeat the same test.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I think if anybody I know that's had a positive rapid test, I would assume they're positive and wait for the PCR to come back. It's really problematic because I think, you know, I've had some friends and colleagues who've had a rapid test. They're asymptomatic. They wanted to go visit family or something. So they got the test. It comes back positive. They're asymptomatic. And then they get the PCR. They have to wait 5 days or 3 days or whatever for it. And they have to quarantine themselves during that time. Yep. And then, you know, the PCR does have better sensitivity and specificity, of course. And if it comes back positive, it, of course, confirms it. If it comes back negative, you're still kind of, you know, stuck trying to make that decision whether you should quarantine yourself on the off chance it's a false negative.
Yeah.
So I want to ask another question that came up about any updates about convalescent plasma. And I did see a a recent article that pointed out that one of the trial that was ongoing, believe it had to be stopped because there was no benefit. So it was being tested and it looked at for those who were severely ill, and they halted the trial because they were not seeing any benefits. I believe there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine a few weeks ago or a week ago. We'll try to put that into our library. All of your comments, we do have them. If we didn't address something thoroughly, we'll try to make sure we get it addressed. Thank you guys for participating, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.